In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the federal income tax. It is the kind of thing that distresses a lot of people greatly. People like to complain about it. And in fact, there are some people who think we would be better off if we completely scrapped the system that we have now, get rid of it, and start from the very beginning. We'll be talking this morning with the author of a recent book who argues, in fact, that the system certainly does have problems and it needs to be changed, but he would say we don't need to scrap the system and start from the beginning. It is possible for the system to be reformed so that it will generate revenue for the government, but will also be less complicated and more fair than the system that we have now. Our guest is John Fox. He's an attorney in Washington, D.C., and has practiced law there since 1964. He specializes in tax and business matters. He also teaches at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. He's a visiting lecturer there and talks on this subject often. In fact, he's also written a book on it, which is titled If Americans Really Understood the Income Tax. The subtitle is Uncovering Our Most Expensive Ignorance, which not only looks at the income tax, how it works, how it's structured, and also how he would suggest that things could be changed. So as we talk this morning with John Fox, you should certainly feel free to call in. Maybe you have questions or comments. They're certainly welcome. All we ask of people is that folks just try to be brief just so we can get in as many different people as possible. And if you'd like to call in, the number 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So again, 333-WILL. That's one way to think about it. That's what you get if you match the numbers and the letters, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Fox, hello.
Well, hello. Glad to be with you, David.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. And just the basic point, again, is that you're feeling that for those people who would say the federal tax code is beyond help, we ought to just throw it out and start again, you would say, no, we really don't. It certainly needs work, but it's something that we could reform, and it's not necessary for us just to scrap the whole thing and start from the very beginning.
Well, you've expressed it correctly. I think that we can have a much fairer and more economically efficient income tax if we vastly simplified the system. What Congress has given us over the years is something that is massively complicated. It slows economic growth. It creates enormous opportunities for people who have greater abilities to pay very modest amounts. So we end up with lots of arbitrary results so that equals don't pay equally. I think we could do far better, and I prefer that to going to, say, a consumption tax or a flat tax, which we can discuss during the course of this program.
Sure. Well, let me ask a very basic sort of question, because I think that there's the perception out there that while we may talk about the system as being progressive, that is, the idea is that the more you make, the more you pay, that in fact that it doesn't quite work that way, and that for poor people, they may not make enough to have to pay tax, or there's the earned income tax credit, which is supposed to help working poor. There are rich people, and we know that they have ways to shelter their income. And the perception, I think, is that the people on the middle face the greatest sort of tax burden. Is that sort of picture true? Is that the way that it is?
Well, the answer is that it's sometimes true, and often it's not true. Let me be clear about this. The progressive income tax, on average, requires that people who are at the top, have the highest income, actually pay substantially more, progressively more, than, say, people in the middle. The top 1%, for example, of all income taxpayers pay about 32% of all income taxes on maybe 16% of all income. So at first blush, it looks like the people at the top really pay disproportionately more. And I think that often happens, but it also happens that many people pay very little who are at the top because of the reasons you've just described. There are many ways to avoid taxes. And people in the middle also will vary enormously. If you're in the middle and you work for a company that offers lots of fringe benefits, cafeteria plans, and you can shelter lots of personal expenses, then you will do better than somebody else with exactly the same income who's working for a company, say a family business. And that business says, we just can't afford to set up these plans, so we're going to pay you your wages as wages. And so you've got to report all of your income. And so it's for these reasons and many more that I object to our system, because it means that the outcomes are very arbitrary. Equals too often do not pay equally.
There is the perception, I'm sure, that people have that year after year after year, our tax burden continues to go up. And certainly there are many different taxes that we have to pay, Social Security and Medicare. And there's sales taxes, and many states have income taxes. We have the federal income tax. But one of the things that you point out in the book is, in fact, when you look just at federal income tax and look at that as a percentage of GDP, gross domestic product, in fact, that it hasn't changed significantly in more than two decades. And not only that, for those people who complain and think that here in the United States we pay too much tax, people in other countries, other industrialized countries, are paying more.
That's exactly right. We pay a smaller percentage of our GDP in federal taxes than the European countries do. They offer more services. We're the only country, advanced industrialized country in the world, that doesn't have universal health care, for example. But where federal taxes have gone up significantly is through Social Security and Medicare. And I point that out in the book. And that means that the ordinary worker is not paying proportionally more in income taxes, but he or she is paying substantially more in Social Security taxes. In fact, as I note in the book, about three-quarters of all taxpayers pay more in Social Security taxes than they pay in income taxes.
We have a caller, and I think we'll get right to them and not make them wait. The caller is in Aurora on our toll-free line. This is line number four. Hello.
Yes, hi, good morning. I just had this problem about 2 weeks ago and didn't realize I might get an answer this fast. My question is, why does a person who has rental property and it is for a business, the rooms are rented and a business is set up, if they have non-payment, they can write that off as a loss. But if you have property that is rental property for people to live in, and if there is non-payment in that situation, the person who owns it can't write it off as a loss.
Well, the rules are a little complicated. The loss that you, if somebody owes you rent and you don't receive the rent, you don't get a deduction. You simply don't have any rental income from that person. Mm-hmm. If, however, they gave you a promissory note to pay the rent, and if somebody promised to pay you and actually gave you a promissory note and they didn't pay, then you could write off that loss. But
really?
If somebody has promised to pay you rent and you have a rental business, that was your first situation, you have rental property and you're renting it out.
Yeah, and it's for business.
And it's for business. And somebody doesn't, let's say, pay the August rent.
Yeah.
You don't report that rent as income then. So there's no loss. You just, let's say they owed you $1,000. You'll have $1,000 less of income. It isn't a loss. Now, if you have your second example, what are you thinking about in the second example?
Rental property that people live in and don't pay the rent. I can't write, my accountant told me I can't write it off as a loss because it's a living quarters.
Yes, if it's a place that is primarily your personal residence, and if
no, it isn't mine. No, it isn't mine.
Okay, it's but you can again. The I think the problem is a little different. If you can't, there isn't a loss that you write off if somebody pays. It doesn't pay you rent. You simply don't report the rent as income, and therefore it never shows up as part on your income statement as income. It is in effect like a loss. And if somebody were renting the basement apartment, for example, in their house, and they didn't get that rental income, they would simply not report the income. So I think what your accountant said to you may have been involving a slightly different circumstance. But
yeah, I know it is. One is my daughter has rental property, but she rents it out for business. My business is rental property, but I rent it out for people to live in, and the rent isn't paid.
Yeah, I think you end up with the same result, and I think you're...
No, the person with the business in it, they're able to write off a loss if the rent isn't paid. if they don't get rent.
But what would the loss be? What would they be writing off? Let's say that $1,000 is owed.
Non-payment of money.
Well, in effect, they would never recognize the rental income. So they, in effect, have a loss. It's the same loss that you would have. I suggested.
I can't write it off as a loss because
it's not a loss. It's just not income. You never got the income, so the income does not show up in your tax return. In the same way, a business, your daughter who doesn't get the rental check is never going to report that $1,000 of rental income. That, in effect, is her loss. It's the same thing for you. I think maybe your accountant is describing something different, but that's as far as I can take you on this.
But if I write a promissory note, that might...
You really don't want that. In other words, you've lost the money.
Yes, I've lost the money.
You hope they will pay you. If they agree to give you a promissory note, and if you talk to your accountant, if you had to report the promissory note as, in fact, rental income, and they didn't pay you, then you would write off the promissory note as a loss.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. We have another person here. We'll get right to it, and maybe I should introduce again our guest. We're speaking with John Fox. He is an attorney. He practices law in Washington, D.C., and specializes in tax and business matters. And here this morning, we're talking about changes, potential changes in the federal income tax. He's written about this in his book, If Americans Really Understood the Income Tax, Uncovering Our Most Expensive Ignorance. It's published by Westview Press, and in the book, he argues for certain kinds of changes and reforms that he said would make for a much better system, rather than just saying, well, let's scrap the whole thing. And questions welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Let's go on here. We have someone on our line number one in Champaign County. Hello.
Hi. Westview used to be a good press, but I think Murdoch's bought it. This is supposed to be more of a theoretical discussion of taxes as opposed to consulting, so I think I'll go that way. But I wanted to point out something that I saw as... why people are so ignorant. There was just this parade, which is the insert in Sunday newspapers, has a column called Intelligence Report, and someone wrote in and asked the head of Microsoft was going to what he was going to see on his taxes, and they just answered that he would be seeing the same $300 rebate that everybody else was, but didn't talk about the other decreases in marginal rates, which. It's really a lot of cash. It was amazingly unsophisticated and just shockingly so to not point out the next thing is, of course he got the $300 rebate because that was going to everybody regardless because everybody who's at the at least 15, now 10% rate. The other thing I wanted to point out and have your comments on is it was actually this rebate business came out of the Progressive Caucus. It was offered instead of the massive attack on progressivity at the upper levels, which has gone ahead. Well, it's not massive because it's being phased in, et cetera, and maybe it can be turned around, I hope. But it wasn't in the Bush plan at all, and now they're glibly taking credit for it. It actually came out of the small, albeit still there, Progressive Caucus. So what are your reactions to those two things, if you would?
Well, I love your first question in particular because the amount of ignorance that Americans have on these subjects is, for the most part, not their own fault. It is very much that we've never studied taxation in school and college. I've created a course at Mount Holyoke College called Taxation and the Values of Democracy with the idea that we ought to introduce into the liberal arts curriculum a real study of taxation. After all, it's nonsense to believe that you should study U.S. history, U.S. government, politics, an whole range of subjects and not introduce the role of taxation. Now, let me turn specifically to your comment about marginal rates. It was so striking to me, as it is to you, that the marginal rates that were reduced in the latest tax legislation were very large at the top and minuscule at the bottom. Let me be specific. The 39.6% rate, which is the top rate before the legislation, is going to fall to 35%. So that's a substantial drop in rates over time. And that's on all income over about $300,000. So if you have $10 million of income, you're going to save over 4 percentage points on that income. at the bottom, the 15% rate, which is the current rate, that was reduced to 10% only for the first $6,000 of taxable income for single people and to $12,000 for people filing a joint return. In other words, most of the of their income that is taxed at 15% currently is going to continue to be taxed at 15%. And let me add one other thing. About three-quarters of all taxpayers pay no more than the 15% rate. So what the caller has suggested is that when you look at the big picture, much of which is in the reduction of tax rates, most people who are just at the 15% rate got a minuscule reduction in their tax rate, whereas people at the top got a very large one. And if the press doesn't report that, there is a great misunderstanding about what this law involves. And you're quite right. The rebate came out of the Progressive Caucus because they were saying so much of the tax relief was for people in the upper categories. We ought to give more to people at the bottom, particularly to create more consumption at this time of the economic distress in the country. But it's not a huge amount, as you say, $300 or $600.
Yeah, I think they were actually saying we should do this instead of the upper rates, and now it got compromised together. So. Anyway, the other thing I wanted to point out is just you mentioned the media coverage is that there's fairness and accuracy in reporting. There's a study that shows that on economic issues, free trade, tax policy, et cetera, media people are overwhelmingly more conservative than the average, quote, average American's point of view on this. So I really think that explains that. Now, not all media people are dragging in, you know, ten thousands and like the news readers we have who get so much money for being spokespeople for whatever multinational corporation. Anyway, I'm getting away from the subject, but the point is that on economic issues, our so-called liberal media is quite conservative, and I think that's really why. But this idea of calling this the intelligence report and then saying, well, the head of Microsoft and all the other people are getting their $300 rebates just like you. It was just beyond belief. Anyway, I think I'll hang up.
All right, thanks.
Let me just make sort of a general comment by giving you a specific example. What I argue in my book is that both true conservatives and true liberals, if they were to get together outside of the political realm, they weren't running for political office, would agree to vastly simplify the system and bring tax rates down for everybody. And I gave a talk at Mount Holyoke College to some alums, and at this talk was an economist who writes for Forbes magazine, a very conservative magazine, as you know. And I made I offered this proposition that most of the tax relief that exists today goes to people in the higher marginal tax brackets because they are exclusions and deductions and deferrals, which have most value for people who would pay the highest tax rate on this income. And I said, rather than do this, rather than give huge housing allowances through the mortgage interest deduction and huge exclusions for employer payments of health insurance premiums and the rest, which primarily help them when in fact they don't need the help, our economy would be stronger. We'd have a fairer system if tax rates simply were lowered for those at the top as well as those at the bottom. And I believe that if you get away from the politicians and you get to the economists, and this fellow agreed in a moment, and liberal economists agree. So it's not a matter that conservative economists or liberal economists actually disagree about the fundamental changes that are needed by the income tax laws. They all agree that our system is highly inefficient. And if they got together, we could end up with, and they were the ones writing the code, we'd end up with a system where tax rates could be as low as 10% for most people, less than 30% for people at the top, which would give you a stronger economy and have the Congress less active in micromanaging our financial decisions.
Just also to be clear, and you do explain this in the book that you've written, that you're talking about, in addition to doing that, you would significantly eliminate the exclusions and deductions and a lot of that stuff like that that now results in a good deal of income legally not being taxed.
The figures are actually astonishing, David. About half of all of our income, individual income, is untaxed, legally untaxed, because of about 160, 170 special relief provisions, loopholes, carrots, whatever you want to call them, in the tax laws. This year, that'll amount to about $3 trillion of income that is untaxed. Now, that sounds great to people at first. Are, you know, is John Fox in favor of taxing all that income? What you must realize, everybody realizes, that the government's going to get the tax money one way or the other. So the consequences of all of these exclusions and deferrals, I'm not throwing away all of them, but the consequences of them are that our tax rates on the income that is subject to tax are much higher than they otherwise would have to be. And not only are the tax rates much higher, but the relief provisions are favoring some people over other people. Many people don't get any of the relief. Take itemized deductions. Only 30% of all taxpayers itemize. That means 70% don't. So, and I go through this and why these itemized deductions are very difficult to justify as either social or economic policy. And we can talk more about that.
We have another caller we'll get to in a moment. I suppose I should introduce again our guest. We're speaking with John Fox. He is an attorney in Washington, D.C., has practiced since 1964, and he specializes in tax and business matters. He's also a visiting lecturer at Mount Holyoke College, which is in Massachusetts, and author of the book that explores the income tax, how it is, how it works, and how it is it perhaps should be changed. His book is titled If Americans Really Understood the Income Tax, Uncovering Our Most Expensive Ignorance, and it's published by the Westview Press. And we have some other folks to talk with here. Terre Haute is next, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hey, I keep hearing this expression, marginal tax rate. What in the heck do they mean?
The marginal tax rate is the very top tax rate that you reach on your income. And let me just make a general statement because I think most taxpayers are actually confused by this. We have tax rates currently running from 15% to 28% to 31% to 33% to 39.6%. The new laws change that slightly. And when you have so much taxable income taxed at 15%, you might, if let's say you're single, the tax rate moves to 28% on, let's say, taxable income above $25,000. Let's say you had $26,000 of taxable income. Well, you would pay the 15% rate on the first $25,000, and then the marginal rate, the top marginal rate, becomes 28% on the next $1,000. So your marginal tax rate, your top marginal tax rate, is the tax rate that applies, in effect, to your last dollar of taxable income. And that's a crucial thing because we often think about if we earn another dollar of income, if we cash in our stocks, or we get some more dividends, or should we get tax-exempt interest, what we're thinking about is that marginal tax rate. What tax rate would apply to that particular income?
Yeah, that's another big scam that government's pulled over. You know, the more I read and hear about this so-called tax bill that we just got passed or are going to get passed, whatever, it really is not for three-fourths of us people, the way I'm beginning to get, understand it.
What did you? I couldn't quite hear. What did you say about three-quarters of us?
In other words, the three-fourths of us people who pay most of the taxes, you know, we're not getting there any breaks on it, really.
Well, the figures are quite astonishing, in fact. Those published by quite reliable services say that the top 1%, when the new tax laws will be fully phased in, will get annually something in the range of $45,000 to $50,000 of tax relief. The middle 20%, so thinking about everybody who's right in that middle, they will get on average about $600 a year. Mm-hmm. And people at the bottom, of course, don't pay taxes.
Yeah.
So what the caller is saying is that this is heavily weighted towards people at the top. Now, I think we need to say that people at the top, as I said early in this broadcast, pay disproportionately more in income taxes. But in fact, if you look at the total share of tax relief that they're getting, from both the estate tax relief and the income tax relief, they're getting somewhere in the neighborhood of about 35% of all the tax savings. and their federal tax burden is only about 24% of all taxes. So they're getting not just a lot, but they're getting disproportionately more of the relief than their share of all federal taxes. And I think that's why a lot of the critics are saying this was over, this was far too much balance in favor of people at the top.
Just for, I appreciate the comments of the caller, and I need to go on because we're getting a lot of other folks. Just for a second, can we talk about the idea of the flat tax, just because it's been something that conservatives, particularly for some years now, have been advocating as a way of claiming that the system could be made more fair and more simple, particularly. We remember people talking about the fact that we could reduce the size of the forms that people would fill out to the size of a postcard. What do you think of the idea of quote unquote, and of course, different people have different numbers to put on it, but basically the idea is the same. What do you think about the idea of the flat tax?
Well, David, I actually spent an entire chapter in the book discussing that as an alternative. And I see it as an alternative to a simplified income tax, and I think it is less attractive. Let me give you the principal reason. There are actually two reasons I have. The dominant flat tax proposals, those by Steve Forbes, by Army Shelby, it sounds like it's simply a flat rate on all of our income. But in fact, they do not tax any capital gains, dividends, interest, passive income. So if you, David, are a multimillionaire living off of your stocks and bonds, you wouldn't pay a nickel in federal flat taxes. You wouldn't pay any flat tax. And so the consequence of that is that the middle income worker is going to pick up the bill because the flat tax does not tax passive income. It must tax earned income. I think that's unfair, and I think it is not necessary in order to have a strong economy. The flat tax also has a single flat rate. And in order to have a single flat rate that raises the same revenue as you would get today, that rate has to be somewhere around 21%. And unless and the proponents admit this, the early proponents, Hall and Rabushka, who invented this idea of a flat tax, unless the flat tax really stimulates economic growth in a way that it feeds down to the ordinary workers, they admit in their treatise that it will result in a tremendous tax savings for people at the top and somewhat higher taxes for people in the middle. I don't believe the flat tax would end up stimulating economic growth sufficiently to warrant that kind of shift of taxes. So I think it's too favorable to people who live off their unearned income. And I believe in a moderately progressive tax rate. Having said that, I think we can vastly simplify the system, the income tax. We could have a system that is, for the most people, reported over the Internet. They could do it on something equivalent to a large card. We could get there if people were willing to give up a lot of the special relief provisions and have much lower rates for everybody.
Let's talk with another caller. Chicago, line one. Hello.
Right off the top, a general question as to the areas that they thought of to tax but haven't gotten around to taxing yet. I imagine they've tried to scrape the bottom of the barrel for everything. But there's an area in the Internet where they still have not decided to tax anything. There's something like a moratorium on all the transactions that take place, and I'm wondering what the reason is for their not having done so. It's a lucrative area. Who knows of boundless transactions and amounts. I was wondering if anybody knows why they and how much has gone through and if ever will they get around to taxing on the Internet.
Well, I'm not an expert in that at all, but I have the same concern that you do. I think it is extremely unfair to all of the retailers who are marketing and have to collect the sales tax or use tax. But over the Internet, they're exempt. It gives an enormous advantage to the companies, and they're often large companies that can market over the Internet. The argument is that it gets complicated with individual state taxes and how to develop the system, but I believe that they ought to solve that problem and not give this highly favorable, highly discriminatory advantage to Internet retailers. So I'm all with you.
The second question relates to the fact that what was the so-called faith-based initiative and people wanting to make donations and so forth. Envision another area of tax structure that can get pretty complicated, plus the matter of foundations. I remember something like 10 years ago when some changes in the tax rules came about, the Rockefeller Foundation particularly said, well, looks like we'll have to adjust our areas of donations and that to diminish them and maybe spread it out, their investments overseas because of changes in tax structures. So a lot of thinking has to go through this. You almost need a Pentagon type approach to dealing with taxes.
Well, it's just one of many examples that you've cited. If we got into something which said that you got special charitable deduction for giving to organizations that are called faith-based, then we'll have to define that. And
yeah,
defining that is going to end up with, I'm guaranteeing you, reams of regulations, of litigation and everything else. So it simply is another example of why we shouldn't go in that direction, why we should try to simplify the laws rather than create what sound like, in some people's minds, a sort of worthy social goal. But when you try to implement it through the income tax system, you end up with, we have 144 pages right now of instructions on the income tax return. We now have this new set of legislation that is a new 186 pages of complexity. I'm sure we're going to have 160 or 165 pages of instruction. If we had a special charitable deduction for faith-based organizations, you'd add many more pages. So I think it's the wrong way to go. I think the income tax should be viewed much more as a way of raising revenue at the lowest possible rates. The great advantage of doing it that way is that we have much more confidence that if we paid our fair share, that others would too, and we'd have a stronger economy.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Well, in your thinking about reforming the system, would you retain a deduction for a charitable contribution?
I would, David. I would change it, though, from what it is. Right now, it's an itemized deduction. Only people who itemize get to deduct their charitable contributions. And that means, again, only 30% of all taxpayers itemize. And I think that's unfair because, David, if let's say you had a high mortgage interest payment, so you itemized and you gave $100 to charity. Well, you can deduct the $100 even if you have, say, $200,000 of income, and nobody would say that you were charitable. So I don't believe just because you itemized you should be able to deduct all of your charitable gifts. I think what we should do is say that everybody, all taxpayers, can get a charitable deduction. But I would say there are two conditions in order to make it administratively fair and to prove that, in fact, people are charitable. I think there ought to be a threshold. That is that if you give something like over 3% of your adjusted gross income, I think John F. Kennedy said over 5%. But somewhere in that, there ought to be a threshold below which everybody's going to give something. So it ought to be an inducement. If you're really charitable, whether you have $20,000 or $200,000, then you would get the deduction. But if you weren't really charitable, then you wouldn't get the deduction. So put a threshold in there for contributions in excess of some percentage of your adjusted gross income. And then administratively, let's say it's got to be a total of at least, say, $500 or $1,000 so the IRS can administer it. But take it away from being something that simply favors people at the top and doesn't give the opportunity to people who are the ordinary taxpayers, who actually are often, as a percentage of their income, much more generous than rich people are.
Mm-hmm. To next caller, this is Champagne. It's line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question regarding this $300 tax rebate check that we are getting. My understanding is this does not relate to taxes of the year of 2000. This is for the prepayment for 2001 taxes. In other words, by end of 2001, if you were supposed to get $500 rebate, now you are getting you got $300 already. You will get $200. Is that correct statement or not?
That in fact this is a rebate of the taxes that you paid for the year 2000. So that if you didn't pay any taxes in 2000, you won't get any rebate. And so they looked at our tax returns for the year 2000, and they said we're going to multiply by 5% the amount of taxes that we paid. And if it came to $300 or up to $300 or more for single people, then you got that. If it came to $600 or more for people filing a joint return, then it came to that. So this is a rebate for amounts that you paid for the tax year ending in 2000 and not for the year 2001.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. I have heard people say the same sort of thing, that somehow what this is an advance on what we would get next year, so that either that means that next year either we end up paying more or we end up getting back less. And I guess I've never been quite sure that I understood that. So is that not the does this not have any effect at all on the amount of money that we will pay or the amount of refund that one might get for tax year 2001?
My understanding is that it does not, it won't affect that. That the tax bill has lower tax rates that begin to get phased in, but the rebate that we have is not going to reduce our or is not going to affect our 2001 tax liability. I may be wrong on that because it's a very technical provision. I hadn't been asked that question, and I'm not saying this is gospel, but I know it is a refund of amounts paid in 2000. If you didn't pay it in 2000, you wouldn't get any rebate. And I don't think that the $300, let's say, that a single person gets back now is going to alter their tax liability in 2001. But perhaps somebody would correct me on that.
Okay. Let's go to Urbana for another caller. This is line three. Hello.
Hi. This is a refreshingly rational conversation about taxes. I have a simple
thank
question.
Thank you.
I have a simple question. I'm curious, what percentage of my tax dollar goes to paying interest on the national debt?
Well, the interest on the national, the income tax, individual income tax revenues will be approximately $1 trillion for this year, approximately. And interest on the national debt will be in the range of, I think, $220 billion, $230 billion. So somewhere in that range. So you can, although I can't identify for your tax dollar, but on it means that of total tax dollars paid, I suppose we could say for everybody, mm-hmm. somewhere in the neighborhood of more than 20% and probably a little less than 25%
yeah.
of those individual income tax dollars will go towards the federal debt.
Well, the reason I bring up this issue is it seems to me that if the national debt were paid off, we'd get a lot more than a $300 break.
Well, yeah. In fact, though, let me just take that and say something that I think again is a sort of failure of the press to make this clear. And I say this not as somebody who favors Republicans or Democrats or either side. The argument for the rebate was in part that we need to stimulate economic growth. And so that aside, though, the argument is that people have overpaid because we're going to have some kind of surplus over the next 10 years. The fact is that the federal debt is $3.5 trillion, exclusive of the Social Security and Medicare debt. So if we had been paying all of our taxes currently, we would have paid off $3.5 trillion. So it isn't that Americans have overpaid. In the short run, you could say that there's some kind of surplus. But in the long run, we've got this huge debt. We should, had we done what we say to our children, which is don't run up those damn credit cards, pay whatever your monthly charges are currently.
Yeah.
If we as taxpayers had done that, we would have had to pay much more taxes. We wouldn't have any of this debt. And we would maybe be more cognizant of the way in which our tax dollars are being used. The government has borrowed heavily in order to carry on the business of government, and I think we have to recognize that this notion that we are getting sort of a refund of an overpayment is, I think, not an accurate statement. We haven't overpaid. We are $3.5 trillion in debt. And so to justify this refund, I think you'd have to say it is to stimulate economic growth, not to give people back what they've overpaid.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. When Mr. Bush was running and talking about the things he would do if elected, the tax cut was at the top, if not near the top of the list. And I suppose some people would argue that it's the most significant thing that, in fact, he's done since being elected. In addition to changing the lowering tax rates, it also calls for a gradual phase out of the estate tax, what the Republicans charmingly came to refer to as the death tax, because they obviously made it sound even worse. What's your thought about the phase out of the estate tax and whether that is good, bad, or indifferent?
Well, I have some strong feelings about it, David. First of all, I share your feeling that calling it a death tax was really a politically clever thing to do, but very inaccurate. because only about 2% of all the states bear any estate tax. So if it's really a death tax, you'd expect more than 2% of all the states to pay it. I'm concerned at two levels. One is that eliminating the estate tax altogether, which happens in the year 2010, is going to cost a lot of revenue. By that year, it will be about, if we had not done it, the estate tax would raise something like $50 billion. That's a lot of money, and that money then has to be raised somewhere else. So if it's not going to be raised from the top 2% of all the states, where are we going to get it? Well, I don't think we should be raising Social Security taxes, so it's going to have to be in corporate and individual income taxes, and typically Congress goes after the individual income tax. So I think that everybody who was saying, well, I don't think an estate tax is fair, needs to understand that there's no free lunch here. We're going to have to pick up that revenue. Secondly, or thirdly, I think it was extremely misleading to say that the estate tax was really unfair to small businesses and farms. My practice in Washington involved representing lots of small businesses, and rarely does a small business ever pay an estate tax. In fact, the figures are that that if you looked at the tax returns for a couple of, from a couple of years ago, something like 2 or 3% of all of the estates that paid taxes had substantial assets that were business assets or farm. So it was really the tail wagging the dog. And lastly, I'd like to say that the estate tax came into being not because of progressives or Democrats, that is, but because people like Andrew Carnegie, who was an enormous capitalist, and President Theodore Roosevelt, who was a Republican and represented and was voted in by people of substantial wealth, were very much concerned about an elitist, a plutocracy growing up, that wealth was being gathered within small groups of families and gave them enormous political power. I worry about that when I think about the elimination of the estate tax altogether.
On again, it's another caller. This is Chicago. It's line 4. Hello.
I'm calling back again. Thank you. I was raising a point about the foundations and other companies that may suddenly say, well, we're going to have to diversify our investments and suddenly put them overseas, and you have things like NAFTA occurring as an aftermath and other things relating to the World Trade Organization. So I can only see the tax structure becoming even more complicated as a result of these different changes of sovereignty and where your corporation is actually located, although you may be in one part of the world and things going on. So I can only have sympathy for the plight of the tax groups that have to calculate all these things that are going on. So anything that can be done to simplify things, I look forward to, but how it'll ever come about, I don't know. But
you've sort of raised two things. One is that it is very difficult now to for the IRS to be able to follow all of the income that is earned abroad and placed in these tax havens. Let me just address it, because that's largely a corporate income tax problem, and let me just address the individual income tax and whether we could really ever get to something that's fairer and simpler. People ask me that, John. They say to me, John, you've written a book that we really understand and we agree with. A lot of people have said that to me, but do you think it's politically feasible? And that's really the crucial question. And my answer is, it's somewhat self-serving, David, but the answer is that it will never happen until Americans do get informed about what all these special provisions mean. I've written this book to provide Americans with the tools to then evaluate what is being offered to them and where we might go, what the alternatives are. So it's a book written for people who are not schooled in economics or tax policy. It's written for the typical American voter who would like to learn about this. I think that if the typical American voter read this book, that he or she would get angry. David, do you remember the movie Nashville? You remember with the television the newscaster who was being fired? He was somewhat of an alcoholic. He was a great figure. He thought television news was false and misleading. And on his last broadcast, he said to the people, "All of you who are fed up, throw up your windows. Remember, throw your windows open and say, I'm fed up. I've had enough. I won't take it anymore." And I'm what I am doing actually is I'm on lots of these radio programs around the country. I'm hoping that the American taxpayer is going to read my book or read something else and get angry. And because we're capable as taxpayers of throwing open the windows and saying to politicians, we've had enough. And we're not going to take it any longer. If enough Americans contact their members of Congress, if they write to them, if they call them, if they say, we want you to go in a different direction, we can achieve something.
Yeah.
But it's tough.
There is so much that we have not talked about, and we're down to the point where we have just a minute or two left. I want to ask you real quick about something. We talked about how much income is legally untaxed because of exclusions and deductions. I'll just ask you about one, which I would think would be one of the most popular because so many people can take advantage of it, and that is the deduction for the interest that we pay on our home mortgages. Would that be something that you would keep or get rid of?
Well, I would refocus it. For it to make sense, it's a housing policy. First of all, I note in the book, this is a housing policy. So what would you do in order to encourage home ownership? Because the premise of Congress in giving housing subsidies is that home ownership is something that's good. We think that people become more focused in their community. They become better people for the community, and it helps families. So if you're going to do that, the mortgage interest deduction, which now is costing the government about $60 billion a year, should not be for very expensive homes, so that I would, or a second home, or for a home equity loan, which doesn't even go into a home. So I would focus the mortgage interest deduction so that it primarily assisted people who were buying a first home to maximize the number of homeowners. I would give some relief to other people, but I would narrow the relief so that, unlike today, where most of the relief is for people at the top and very little of the relief is for people who have modest mortgages and are at modest tax rates, I would say it is sensible if we're going to encourage home ownership. But for people who need to add a seventh bedroom or a fifth bathroom, the government is not in the business of subsidizing that.
Well, we're going to have to stop. And if people are interested in reading more, they should look for the book we've mentioned, If Americans Really Understood the Income Tax, Uncovering Our Most Expensive Ignorance. It's published by the Westview Press by our guest, John Fox. Mr. Fox, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, David, thank you. It was a great pleasure.